Okay, I'm on the northbound actor. Just right at the light.
If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/ganglandwire. Follow true crime storyteller Gary Jenkins on Twitter at Jenks Law. Buy the DVD Gangland Wire or download the Kansas City Mob Tour app. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Good evening, folks. We're back here in the beautiful studios of the Big Dumb Fun Show, Studio 4 in the Ice House right here in Midtown Kansas City. We're on the second segment of at least two-part, maybe three. We'll see how this goes. Interview with Paul Scharf, author of Murder in McHenry. Aaron, this is a compelling story, isn't it?
It is. It was hard to kind of put it down for a second when we were at the end of the last episode with Paul on the phone. We were talking with him. He's in what'd you say, Fort Worth?
That's correct.
And was kind enough to be with us here tonight and to talk about his book and his experiences about the what's really his life.
Yeah, this is definitely your life, isn't it, Paul?
That's correct. Everything is true.
Now, just to kind of recap this, Paul's father was killed when he was 10 years old, and there was no suspects. There was little to no investigation. They kind of looked around at there was a employee of his. He owned a bar and had a woman working there for him, and
who was relatively new.
It was brand new. It was maybe within her first week or so there. The local sheriff, he didn't have a motive or a suspect of any kind. And the first thing you do is start looking at somebody's love life. So they immediately looked at everybody's love life, and they found she had a boyfriend or an ex-boyfriend, and they suspected him, but they couldn't make him on it. So they went in the cold case file for, I don't know how many years, Paul.
27.
27 went in for 27 years in the cold case file, and Paul
fast forwarded to being 37 years old.
Yes, Paul gets a clue from a friend who read it in a true crime book.
His babysitter.
Yes,
my former babysitter.
His former babysitter. So we were before we were at a point where he has contacted the true crime author. He has contacted the co-author and an FBI agent who is kind of the handler of the retired mobster who is now in the witness protection program, and they all are going to help. So why don't we pick it up from there, Paul?
Where I left off, I received an email from Danny Griffin, who is the co-author to the book Collada. And he had spoken to Frank Collada and Dennis Arnoldy and asked them why they didn't turn this information in to McHenry County Sheriff's Office back in 1982 when Frank turned. And they said that they did. So they pledged their help if I was interested in getting Larry Newman named as the killer of my father and Patricia Freeman. They pledged their help to help me go ahead and do so. So I did. I was very interested in doing that. So we started that off by creating a lot of awareness about my father's case. I started off with the NBC5 News in Chicago, told my story there. Holly's sister, Heidi, got in contact with McHenry County Sheriff's Office and asked them, do you have an unsolved murder, an unsolved double homicide? And they said, no, we don't. She goes, you better check again. And got off the phone with them. They wound up calling her back and saying, yeah, we do. And she said, it's in this book, Collada. So we started creating awareness about the case. The sheriff's office started picking it up. But I was very familiar with my home community. And I didn't really trust McHenry County Sheriff's Office. On the radio shows and the public, I put on a smiling face, but I didn't really trust them. But I didn't want to berate them in any way because my mission was get Larry Newman named as the killer of my father. So we did what we did, and that was campaign, tell the story, and the sheriff's office opened up an investigation. And in 2009, they named Larry Newman as the killer of my father under what they called exceptional status. Larry Newman was put to prison by information provided by Frank Collada on another murder that he committed, a jeweler. The jeweler was named Brown, and Larry Newman killed him viciously. He wasn't supposed to kill him. He was supposed to just rob him. But they went into the jewelry store, and there was a machete on the wall. He pulled out the machete, and he hacked Mr. Brown to death. So he was convicted for that and spent the rest of his life in jail because he was a career murderer. This is the second conviction that he had because he was also convicted of a triple homicide that he committed back in 1956 of a bar owner, a bar employee, and a newspaper vendor. So in January 2007, Larry Newman had died. He died of natural causes from prison. I didn't become aware of everything until 2008. They named Larry Newman as the killer of my father under exceptional status, meaning that if he was alive, they would charge him, and they felt most likely that they would be able to prosecute him for the murder of my father. We were able to accomplish that, getting Larry Newman named as the killer of my father. But what the McHenry County Sheriff's Office didn't answer was, why didn't they jump on this information back in 1982? Larry Newman was known to be associated with the Chicago Outfit. He was also convicted of a triple murder back in 1956, where he got 125 years apiece for each of those people, but only served 12 years and got out on parole just to kill three more people that we know of. McHenry County never picked up on that question. I decided that I wanted to write a book about this, so I got my co-author, Keith Settinger, and I asked Keith to go ahead and request my father's file through the Freedom of Information Act. And I said, you know, they're going to like you more than they like me. They don't like me much. You know, you're a former cop. See if you can't be cops with them and get that information. They shut him down not once but twice. And they did it on a very rude level. So we proceeded to go ahead and write the book. Now, my plan was...
Wait, so Paul, they wouldn't provide you the information under the Freedom of Information Act? You requested the case files, and they wouldn't give them to you?
That's right. Or, they know that he's really asking on my behalf.
Yeah.
I'm the victim's son. And, you know, this happened almost 30 years ago. There's really no reason.
It's almost like they had something to hide. They were trying to cover something some lack that they had participated in, some fault they had back when this murder happened. They didn't follow some leads or something. Something's going on here, isn't it?
That's exactly it. Those were my same assumptions. I wrote my book. And by the time that we were releasing the book, the second investigator was Andrew Zanke. The second investigator, he was a slightly better than the first investigator, George Hendel, who later became Sheriff George Hendel, McHenry County Sheriff's Office. But Andy Zanke wasn't much better.
So the guy who investigated this crime before now is the sheriff when you're asking for them to give you copies of their files. Is that what
you're saying? No, he ultimately became sheriff, but I think he died in like 2003. So George Hendel wasn't even around when all this stuff came up. So when it came up again in 2008, 2009, at the time it was Lieutenant Zanke who picked up the second investigation. And I didn't like Zanke. I felt like he was trying to keep information away from me. When they named Larry Newman as the killer of my father, they put it in what they called a letter of notification. And in this letter of notification, there was no new information whatsoever. I knew more information than what was in that letter, except one thing. And the reason why my father was killed was that he threw out Larry Newman's ex-wife out of the bar. She was being drunk and belligerent. And her name was Debbie Newman. So he threw out Debbie Newman, and what she did was she called Larry in Las Vegas, and she called Larry at the restaurant called the Upper Crust. This was Frank Collado's restaurant. And the way Frank Collado recalls is Larry got off this phone, and he was enraged. And he asked him what was going on. He said, this guy back in McHenry threw my ex-wife out of the bar. And he said, okay, is she okay? Is she all right? Yeah, she's fine. He's like, well, what's the problem then? You know, she's your ex-wife for a reason. And he's like, did you know this guy? He's like, yeah, I knew this guy. And he goes, this is disrespect. He disrespected me by throwing my ex-wife out. And I'm going to go back and I'm going to kill him. Well, this is not something that the Chicago Outfit would sanction. They already had a lot of heat, and they didn't need a needless murder to add to the fire. So Frank Collado thought he talked him out of it. And then 2 weeks later, Larry came home back to McHenry County and fulfilled his promise. So that brings us back to the letter of notification. In the letter of notification, there was no new information other than the fact that when Debbie Newman was interviewed, she alleged my father had raped her. And that was the reason why she contacted Larry. In this letter of notification, I took that as an affront because there was no new information other than that. And I felt like they put that information in there, not because they believed it was true, but just to kind of slow me down and say, are you sure you want to uncover stones? Here's what we got.
So, well, she just made the
your father's the rapist.
She made the allegation when they opened the file 27 years later?
That's correct.
She wasn't even interviewed back then, was she? Back when the murder happened.
No. Larry Newman was never interviewed as a suspect either. You know, he should have been, like I said. He was already convicted of a triple murder. He had mob affiliations to the Chicago Outfit, and he knew my father. He was friends with my father. He was from McHenry. So the fact that somebody like that was never interviewed as a suspect is really insane.
Well, he knew your father from McHenry because they both grew up there, not because he was maybe the manager of his coin vending or any of his business ventures.
Well, that's how my father met Larry.
Was it
Mickey Marcello, who was the half brother to James Marcello, who was the Outfit boss prior to the Family Secrets trial? He was our vending management company. Mickey was obviously connected to his half brother. Larry was connected to the Chicago Outfit. So he brought Larry Newman around to the bar.
Yeah.
And that's how my father got to know him.
And that's probably also how Larry Newman's wife ended up at the bar as well.
That's correct. You know, this is a small community. At that time, Lakemore's population was like a little over 800.
Oh,
and,
so,
you know, half those people was related to Patricia.
Right. Everybody knew everybody. Everybody knew everybody.
That's right.
I see what you mean.
Lakemore was right outside of the town McHenry. That's where I was from. So for me, Lakemore was kind of unincorporated part of McHenry. And then the town of McHenry resides in the county of McHenry County. So that can get a little bit confusing.
Yeah.
So this was a small community. You know, we all knew each other. We all knew everybody's lineage. McHenry was still a small town even back then. Was probably getting close to 30,000, maybe. Back then it was probably around 15,000.
Let's go back to Lurch. They called him Lurch.
Larry Newman.
They called him Lurch because he looked like the character Lurch in the Addams Family. Is that if I remember your book right, or I read that somewhere?
That's correct. He was a very big guy.
He was a huge guy. He was a serial killer, basically. He was a psychopathic killer.
You described him as that character from No Country for Old Men.
No Country for Old Men kind of a character Javier Bardem played. The only thing he lacked was that cattle-killing, air-powered stun gun. But he was that kind of a guy. This dead-eyed,
yeah.
I would say.
Well, so at the time...
You know, and And keep in mind, Larry Newman didn't do any of this because he had to.
No,
he did this because he loved this stuff. He loved hurting people. He loved killing people. His, you know, like I said, I mentioned that he got convicted for a triple murder and received 125 years consecutively three times, but got out in 12. Well, I mean, even for Illinois, that's really some high speed corruption there.
Right. Yeah, I was going to say, what was that for, good behavior?
No, what we think happened is his father was wealthy, and we believe that his father spent some money and pulled some strings and got him out of there. So while Larry Newman was paroled, he was living off a trust fund.
And right, he had a trust fund. He didn't have to work. He didn't even have to do all this stuff to earn money. He had a trust fund, if I remember your book right.
That's correct. So every quarter, he would receive $15,000 from his trust fund. Now, we're talking like the 60s and stuff. So he's getting $30,000 a year, which is okay money today.
I could live on that.
40 years. You know, this is 40 years ago. And he was pulling in that kind of money. So every 3 months, he didn't have to do nothing and receive a check for $15,000. He did this stuff because he liked it.
He comes out of jail.
He's running around with Frank Culotta.
Well, first he comes out of jail. He comes out of jail, and he falls in with Chicago mob. They probably saw a guy that they could use for heavyweight stuff. So he's running around Chicago mob guys in Chicago before he goes to Las Vegas.
Well, he met Frank Culotta in prison, and that's where the association was to the Chicago outfit for Larry. So Frank got out of prison, and then Larry got out of prison, and then got in contact with Frank. And that began his affiliation to the Chicago outfit.
And then when he goes to Las Vegas, Frank's gone to Las Vegas to work for his childhood friend, Tony Spilotro. And they bring Lurch out there to be part of what they call the hole-in-the-wall gang, if I remember right.
That's correct. So Tony needed some more enforcement to make sure that he kept the Las Vegas skin under the caps. So he reached out to his friend, Frank Culotta. Tony and Frank, they knew each other when they were shining shoes when they were 10, 11 years old. He said, Frank, you know, go ahead, bring a crew out here. And he's like, you know, this is going to cost money, you know. They're going to have to steal. And Las Vegas at that time, none of the families across the country were able to steal or do any of that kind of stuff. But the kind of pull that Tony Spilotro had said, don't worry about it. Go ahead, put a crew together and bring them out here. And, you know, they can steal and do what they have to do. You get a big score. You kick it up to me. I'll kick it up to the bosses back at home. And so Frank put a group together that was later dubbed the Hole in the Wall Gang. They got that from the newspapers, because back then, when you're talking about alarm systems, the alarm systems were wired around like the doors and around the windows. There wasn't a lot of like motion detectors and that type of thing. So to bypass the alarm system, what they would do is they would simply punch a hole through the wall or punch a hole through the ceiling and come through the ceiling. They were dubbed the Hole in the Wall Gang. And Larry Newman was one of the members.
But they would be robbing, like, jewelry stores and other high-end targets, not actually, like, the casinos or smaller gambling facilities.
It's like you see in the movie Casino. You know, you had, like, car porters or reception people in the hotel, insurance people. They would call in and be like, here's your mark. We got a mark. He's in room such and such. And, you know, they would go from there. So it's just kind of like sales, you know. They had their lead generators out there that would let them know about different types of scores. The person that called in the lead, they would get a little piece for that information. And then these guys would go out, commit the robbery, and, you know, and split it up.
And then they wet their beak.
Send it on up to Tony, who had to kick up maybe back to Chicago. Although I think Tony kept a lot of that action separate from Chicago. I'm not too sure how much they knew about what his hole-in-the-wall gang was doing out there in Las Vegas. They would not have liked it.
That's right. that city was a hands-off city to all mobsters. They weren't supposed to steal. They weren't supposed to kill anybody. They weren't supposed to take out beefs with anybody, because the casino business was just so valuable and so important that they were making so much money off it. They didn't want to mucky it up with, you know, visitors, vacationers getting robbed, getting killed, and that kind of thing. I don't know if Tony Spilotro reported back on what was going on.
Probably never if they heard or robbed anybody in casino. I'm not sure. They did go around the Southwest and did some jewelry store burglaries, because if you remember, he had a jewelry store called the
Gold Rush.
Called the Gold Rush. You're right, called the Gold Rush. And he fenced jewels, gold pieces, and things like that out of there. And they were going around other parts of the Southwest doing those kinds of crimes. It was, I talked to a couple of policemen out there, an FBI agent, Emmett Michaels, was one of them. And he said the best day he ever had in his entire law enforcement career was the night that they set up on the hole-in-the-wall gang and caught them going into a jewelry store and right there in Las Vegas, and caught them all
coming through the wall.
No, actually, he let them go through the wall. The ceiling and got them on the inside. They even had one guy, Joe Blasco. He was a ex-Las Vegas Metro policeman and had been in the intelligence unit at one time and was feeding information out to the Chicago mob.
That's right. That's right. So what we're talking about is the Bertha's robbery that happened on the 4th of July in 1981. A little side note of that, I was with Frank, and this was in like 2009, and him and I were going to go ahead and do a radio show. Now, the reason why they got caught on the 4th of July at Bertha's is because they had a mole with them, a guy named Sal Romano, who they turned, and he was feeding the feds and Metro all the information on the Bertha's heist. But while I was driving around with Frank and we were heading on over to the radio show, I said, hey, man, I don't really believe in a lot of this stuff. I go, but you brought some bad mojo with you on that night. He's like, mojo? He's like, what are you talking about? I go, well, Larry killed my father on June 2nd, 1981. I go, on the 4th of July, I go, that's my father's birthday. And even for Frank, he was like, ooh.
I bet. I would love to have seen the look on his face when you told him that. I didn't know that fact before.
Yeah, he kind of winced. He kind of winced like, ooh, you know. I don't believe Frank believes in a lot of hocus-pocus kind of stuff. Either do I. But there's some things in the world that you just don't mess with.
You can't explain that one.
That's more than coincidental.
That was kind of one of them.
And if I remember this Lurch, Larry Newman, even Tony Spilotro was afraid of him.
Everybody was. The cops were scared of him. The mobsters were scared of him. Frank's relationship with Larry was, I can't say that he really had him on a leash. This dog was kind of running loose, because even Frank had to be careful about how he said things to him, because he could set Larry off and get himself killed.
He was just that unpredictable.
Yeah, he was very unpredictable, and he liked to hurt and kill, and he was not scared or intimidated by anybody.
Now, just to kind of bring this back around, Larry Newman, he was in jail. He died in jail.
In January 2007,
he dies in jail. His ex-wife, still alive?
She isn't now, but she was alive during the second investigation, and they did go ahead and reach out to her at her home in Kentucky.
But then she passed away sometime later. And there was the girlfriend the waitress who worked there was just really, at the end of the day, an innocent bystander who happened to be working there when Lurch decided that he was going to get his respect back.
That's right. Yeah, Patricia Freeman, she was definitely at the wrong place at the wrong time. And I definitely feel a lot about that, as I imagine my father did at that moment. You know, because when Larry showed up, my dad only had one chance. There was no running from the guy or anything like that. The only chance my father had was talking. And I can kind of imagine what went on. This happened in the back of our bar, which there was an apartment there. In the apartment, that's where the both of them were killed. So what I kind of envisioned happening was my father trying to talk sense into him and trying to let him know, you know, I didn't do anything out of disrespect, you know, and probably saying, she's got nothing to do with this, let her go.
But once she was there,
of course, that's not what happened.
Yeah, him knowing that he was going to kill, he didn't want to have her leave as a witness.
That's what I expected. My dad was definitely afraid of Larry Newman. When everything happened, when he threw out his wife, because it became a big ordeal. She was screaming, yelling, I'm coming back with people. She did come back with people. There was people on both sides there that were armed. Everybody had guns back then. They were armed. It was just almost fortunate that nothing happened that night.
And you're talking you're talking about Debbie Newman, Larry Newman's right. wife, coming back in with a bunch of people and guns. And
back when the incident
right.
happened. I mean, the original yeah. incident happened. So.
And then a couple of weeks later, that's when Lurch came home and then killed my father.
But he went back and he told Frank that he did it, or did he not say anything else? I can't remember. He told Frank he wanted to go do it. Frank said, no, don't do it. There's too much heat. You draw too much heat on us.
You're not going to get a pass.
Right.
You're not going to get a pass for this. The outfit's not going to give you a pass. I'm not going to give you a pass. Frank was in trouble himself. He was caught with stolen furniture. Now, considering all the crimes that he committed, stolen furniture is not a big deal. But the problem was, this would have been his third strike. This would have been a career criminal. So he had a cousin through marriage, a guy named Tommy Amata, who was a young kid hanging out with a crowd that he shouldn't have been when he got out of the Navy, who was going to take responsibility for the stolen furniture and say that he stole the furniture and he sold it to Frank. So Frank wanted to put Tommy on ice because Tommy had a warrant. So he wanted to put Tommy on ice to make it to his trial in Las Vegas. So he sent Tommy with Larry when Larry went back to Chicago. So he thought maybe, you know, he thought that he talked Larry out of killing my father, but this might be an additional measure that he could take that would keep Larry cool and not kill my father. But that didn't work out.
So was Tommy there?
Tommy is believed. Tommy originally made a statement back to Detective Dave Grover from Las Vegas Metro. He originally made a statement that he wasn't aware of what was going on, was driving the car, was told to pull over at this bar. He waited in the car. Larry went inside, and then he heard gunshots. And then Larry came back out into the car. He disassembled the weapon, and there's lots of lakes and rivers where I'm from up in McHenry and Lake County. And they were driving over a bridge where they threw out the weapon. He later recanted that story. But I believe that that's actually what happened. I think Tommy's a victim in this as well. He didn't know what was going on. He winds up with Lurch, who he should never be hanging out with. Now he's an accessory to murder. Who's he going to go to?
Nobody. No. He's screwed.
And this information didn't come out in 82. This is a later reinvestigation?
That's correct. That's correct.
They never followed up on Debbie Newman as, you know, having been thrown out of the bar at the time and the connections there with Larry Newman back in what would have been the investigation following up after the original murder.
Well, the very first radio show that we did, it was me, Danny Griffin was the moderator. We had Holly Hager, Jim Hager, so my former babysitter and her father. We had Dennis Arnoldy, the FBI agent, Frank Colada's handler, and Frank Colada. Frank was in Las Vegas and received a phone call about that evening. Jim was there that night when my dad threw out Debbie Newman. And it was kind of wild listening to those guys talk. because they didn't know each other. They never knew about each other, and this is the first time that they're being introduced, but they're talking about Debbie Newman, who they both knew. And they were talking about that night that my father threw him out, because Jim was there that evening, and then Frank was in Las Vegas when Larry got that phone call. So it was a really interesting conversation that kind of came up. If anybody wanted to listen to that radio show, it's on my website, McHenryCounty1981.com. I look for a show, I believe that was in November of 2008, Crime Wire.
Yeah, that would have been a Crime Wire show. Denny Griffin had Crime Wire show back then.
How long was that How long was that radio interview?
It's about an hour long radio show.
We'll share a link on our website or on ganglandwire.com for that so people can find it when we post up the podcast episode.
Yeah, we'll do that. All right. Thanks, Paul. It's been good to be here, folks. We're going to wind this on down. I'll do a little public service announcement here. If you have a friend, relative, loved one who has a problem with drugs and alcohol, make first call your first call, 816-361-5900, or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org.
And you can find Paul Scharf online at
McHenryCounty1981.com. You can get my book, Murder in McHenry, on Amazon.com, both soft cover and digital format.
Music provided by Automatic. Check them out at AutomaticMusic.com.